The information and opinions presented in this ARC Energy Ideas podcast are provided for informational purposes only and are subject to the disclaimer link in the show notes.
This is the ARC Energy Ideas podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas podcast. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. Welcome. So Jackie, you bought a house a couple years ago and then rebuilt.
Yeah, so we built a home and, you know, at the time I'm like, this is the craziest thing I've ever done, building a house. But man, the Canadian real estate market has really taken off. So I'm not feeling like it was such a bad idea at this point.
No, it was great timing for you because even here in Calgary, the supply is tight. Prices have recovered to levels not seen since, I think it's 2014 or something. Nationally, we've had a 25% year-over-year increase.
Yeah, who would have predicted that sitting here a year ago, that the housing market would be up 25%? And it's not just in those big cities like Toronto and Vancouver.
No.
Even small towns, you're seeing articles about housing prices in small towns.
Oh, yeah, like places where people want to work and live. Here in Alberta, for example, Canmore, just booming. Other places in Ontario that are outside of the main hubs, you know, Toronto and that whole population center.
Yeah, people think they're going to be working remotely for a long time, I guess.
And given the way things are going, they might be.
People are spending so much time at their home. You know, before you spent almost no time at your home. Now it's like everything, working out, kids are playing in the house, doing school in the house. And then it combined with these low interest rates, it's meaning that people can't afford to get a bigger house.
So we do hear these bidding wars and the frenzy, but one of the things that's interesting is, are people actually factoring in the energy characteristics of the home into their bids? I argue not, because you know the prices are so exorbitant in some of the hot market areas. But in other words, if it's an inefficient home that's poorly insulated, poor windows, old gas-fired furnace, that kind of thing, in anticipation of all the net zero legislation, including carbon taxes rising to $170 a ton, that's going to substantially increase natural gas or oil-fired furnaces. Are people actually factoring in that into their prices?
Okay, well, that'll be the topic of our podcast. I would tell you, and we'll talk about it more in the podcast, that if I had known about that carbon tax, I think I would have made some different decisions on the home we just built. So I am not maybe your average person who would actually calculate all this stuff, but I think it will drive different behaviors. But I'm not sure during a bidding war if it does, because people are just all wanting to get that
property. So you would have made a different choice on your heating system.
Yeah, I think I would have.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I would have definitely spent more time looking at it seriously anyway and looking at the
cost. Okay, well, we'll talk about that.
But first, let's talk about this carbon pledge that Canada made, and a bit about Canada's emissions and why maybe efficiency is such an important topic. So as we mentioned briefly on the last podcast, Canada has now committed to an even more aggressive goal of 40 to 45% reduction in the overall emissions by 2030 versus this 2005 baseline. And this was a revision that happened just 4 days after the newest target, which was a 36% reduction in the budget.
Right.
So we're getting more aggressive all the time. The history is not great, though. I think maybe not everyone recognizes, but if you go look at Canada's emissions, overall, we haven't really seen much decrease since 2005. So we have a lot of work to do. And most other big countries have seen a decline in their emissions over that time period.
Yeah, and that's largely in their power grid. So we want to talk about that.
So let's talk about Canada's emissions, because it kind of helps you understand the challenge of trying to make these goals. So what are the different categories of emissions that make up Canadian GHG?
Well, let's start with the power sector, because that's the one that is most consequential. You know, many countries who make these sorts of pledges, a lot of them have a lot of, say, coal power already. And so for them to make the pledge and say, okay, we're going to go to renewables and even potentially natural gas, which substantially cuts your emissions. That's what happened in the United States over the last 10 years, the migration from coal to gas, fired power, and now to renewables. So the irony is here, the dirtier your power, centralized electrical power system, the easier it is to achieve large-scale emission cuts. Here in Canada, our challenge is in making big pledges is that we are dominantly hydroelectric power in the country.
So our overall emissions from electricity are way different than most countries.
Exactly.
They're in the range of a bit over 10% compared to the Americans. They're almost three times higher. So for them to pledge that they're going to zero emissions electricity by 2035, they're just wiping out like 30% of their emissions. So for us, if we made the similar pledge,
right,
it would only get rid of about 10.
Exactly. So if you look at the profile of our electrical power generation and do it by province, you kind of get a sense of the polarization in this country as well, because you have Quebec, which is almost 100% hydro, British Columbia, which is almost 100% hydro, Manitoba. And so you have provinces for them that are already there.
Mm-hmm. And we have nuclear in Ontario, so they're relatively low
in Ontario.
Too.
Yeah. Ontario over the last 10 years has almost completely phased out its coal. Its electricity from natural gas is down substantially. So when you think about cutting from electrical power generation in this country, you're dominantly looking at two provinces, which is Alberta and Saskatchewan.
And they're planning to do that.
Yes.
We are planning to phase out the coal.
Yeah.
But that's just not going to get us there. So the big thing we have in Canada is a lot of industrial-related emissions. Over 40% of all the emissions in Canada are coming from industry. 25% of all the emissions in Canada are coming from the oil and gas. So, you know, majority of that is coming from oil and gas. The U.S. is about half that, just to give you an idea. And so are most other economies. So we have almost double the emissions from industry than most other countries have. And that's problematic because a lot of these industries are export industries. And so to reduce the emissions may mean increasing the costs and making them less competitive. So that's always the concern.
But that is the big challenge. And heavy industry is difficult because it basically means retooling your processes to make conversions from your emissions to becoming net zero or zero carbon. And it's not as simple as what I call plug and play. Buying an electric car and swapping out your internal combustion engine vehicle is a plug-and-play exercise on the back end of the energy cycle. For heavy industries, many of them, they have to retool, repipe, rewire their entire operations.
Mm-hmm. But maybe the only thing that could make it more simple is this carbon capture storage. And it was interesting to see that the budget supported that. We are going to have a future podcast on getting into the details of that, but that is one thing that could really help industry emissions in the short term, because it doesn't require so much of that retooling.
Yeah, and if you think about a lot of heavy industry outside oil and gas is in the manufacturing provinces, say Quebec, Ontario, and so on, and for them carbon capture is difficult because dominantly on the Canadian Shield, they don't have the pore space of the geology that we have in the West. So ditto in parts of the United States, which is why you're seeing direct air capture of carbon, getting the big machinery like a big blower to suck in air from the atmosphere, separate the CO2, and then pump it into the empty pore space in the Permian in Texas and places like that. And I think we're going to start to see that here as well, that a steel plant can remove its carbon in the shorter term by getting into a deal with direct air capture and injecting it into the pore space that we have, for example, here, plenty of in Alberta. Over the long term, they would switch out their processes to, say, completely of whether it's hydrogen, green hydrogen, whatever.
Yeah, but in the short term, that can make a big difference. And I do think we're going to have this future podcast. I do agree with you that I think we're going to see some exciting opportunities there in Canada. But also important in that is trying to reduce as much the CO2 you do create, because that's going to make your problem a lot easier to deal with. And we think energy efficiency, it's really, really important, but not really that loved or that talked about. But that can make a big, big difference in terms of reducing the amount of CO2 that we need to deal with.
This is a low-hanging fruit because the reality of our energy systems from beginning to end, very inefficient, generally speaking.
Yeah.
And so that's the bad news, but it's also the good news. Because if you're starting from an inefficient baseline, becoming more efficient can reap real dividends.
Well, and we've talked about this before, but these low carbon scenarios, like the sustainable development scenario from the IEA, and we had Fatih Birol tell us about this, about a third of the changes over the next 20 years need to be coming from energy efficiency. In the past, primary energy globally growth has averaged about 2% each year. So every year, because people are becoming more wealthy and there are more people, we're increasing the amount of energy we use. And these types of scenarios assume that flatlines, and the only way that can flatline, really, if we continue to think that we're going to grow our population and people are going to get more wealthy, is just to be more efficient.
Right.
And so there's a huge focus in the stimulus spending that's been rolling out here. We talked about the Biden plan having $200 billion or so towards energy efficiency. That's the biggest area of focus. The Liberal climate plan back in December pledged about $6 billion for energy efficiency. And now with this budget that was released last week, there was also a lot of emphasis on energy efficiency, something like $3.5 billion going towards encouraging people to reduce their energy use at their homes.
So, I mean, this is a low-hanging fruit, as I said, because the fastest way to reduce emissions is to reduce consumption. But people don't want to reduce their consumption in terms of the way it affects their lifestyle. But if you can reduce consumption sort of behind the scenes by using less energy to accomplish the same amount of, say, heat in your home or light in your home or mobility in your car, then it's not visible really to the consumer. It's just like buying a more efficient refrigerator and using less electricity. It still accomplishes keeping your food cold. So there's a lot of spending. The majority of the spending, as you just highlighted, is going there. And it makes a lot of sense. And if we sort of borrow from the parlance of the COVID-19 pandemic, what the IEA and others are effectively saying is we need to flatten the curve of consumption.
That's right.
Because the trajectory of consumption of energy going forward, which under a business as usual case, is going up linearly and is dominantly being powered by fossil fuels. So the first order of business is to flatten the curve of consumption with efficiency. And then the second order of business, or concurrently, is to start to think about how you restructure the systems to be more decarbonized in terms of the sources.
Exactly. This is already a huge challenge just to replace the existing amount of energy we use. So you can't make the challenge keep growing on you by continuing to increase your energy.
Yeah.
I'll talk a little bit more, but this is one area that governments have spent, this is not a new thing, actually. Governments have spent a lot of time trying to encourage people to do energy efficiency. Even at the industrial level, we've had things like Emissions Reductions Alberta, where they give grants and things like that to companies that are going to put money into energy efficiency, as well as other things. And there's been various other provincial programs at the industrial level and even at the consumer level. I did want to mention at the consumer level, this new budget also offers up to $40,000 for an interest-free loan if you put that towards home energy efficiency. So we're going to get to that, because will that get people to invest in this? Because there are a lot of barriers to why people don't do this. For example, these high upfront costs, like would you rather spend $20,000 on something that nobody can see? And actually a lot of buyers don't value, right? Like if you go put in this expensive heating system that lowers your operating costs, nobody really values it. Not too many people. I know you would do this, Peter. If you got it in, you would tour people through your utility room to show them this this wonderful piece of equipment you got. But it's just less interesting than putting that money towards maybe an electric car or something that has a cool factor.
Yeah, because everybody, if you have your friends over, come and take a look at my new car, and sort of you show it off. Come and look at my utility room. Okay, that's a whole different level of nerdiness that a lot of people don't want to do.
Although we do have friends like that.
Yes, we do have friends like that. But yes, I think you bring up a good point, is how do you get people to have an incentive to do so? I mean, actually, the electric car is a great example, because you know, you and I have talked ad nauseum on these podcasts that the operating cost of an electric vehicle is substantially less than a gasoline-powered vehicle. Here, especially where electricity prices are low. Yet that's still not enough of an inducement, it seems, for people to make a rapid change to buying electric vehicles today. So now you say, well, I can help you reduce your utility bill, which you know most people these days don't see, because there's an automatic debit that happens and you don't even know what your utility bill is. And you say, well, you know, you have to spend $20,000 or $10,000 or whatever the number is to swap out your furnace for a heat pump, etc. If you can't actually see it, measure it, show it off, be proud of it, like it's much more difficult to make happen.
Yeah. Well, another huge issue is most times when heating and cooling systems need to be done on the retrofit side, it's because of an unplanned outage.
Mm-hmm.
Like, why does it always happen that your furnace malfunctions on the coldest day of the winter, right? And are you really going to be thinking about what's the most efficient choice I can make? You know, you're basically phoning the contractor up who's going to come on a Sunday morning and he's going to just pick something and replace it, because you need heat like now.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another real issue, is people don't always, at the moment that they need to do that retrofit, they're not thinking about it and they're not that motivated to do it proactively, right?
Yeah.
Because it's still working.
But let's get back to your choice of heating that you made in your home.
We went with a really efficient furnace, like a natural gas furnace, the highest efficiency you could get. And we put an air conditioner unit on the home as well. And we can talk about this heat pump thing, because I never really even heard about a heat pump a year and a half ago. It's become now a term people are just using all the time.
Yeah.
And I credit the Energy Gang who just did a podcast all on heat pumps. So if you're interested in heat pumps, I really recommend that. But what I learned, and I've done a bit more work on it, is a heat pump is basically the same thing as an air conditioner unit, but it has a few extra parts. So it allows the system to work in reverse.
Right.
So today, an air conditioner, it's basically sucking the heat out of your home and injecting it out to the atmosphere. Well, you can flip it the other way so that you can heat your home in the winter.
Yeah.
Now, the problem is it only works down to about -5 or -8 degrees C outside. But even then, if I put that unit in, today natural gas is cheap and probably there isn't an economic advantage of running that. But as the carbon tax starts to kick in and natural gas price goes from $3 to like $12, I could actually start using that heat pump for the vast majority of the days in Canada. And then on the very cold days, I'll run the furnace. But yeah, that'll probably save me a lot of money. And this is the thing. According to the podcast, The Energy Gang, it's only about $400 extra to take that air conditioner unit and put those extra parts in and buy the one that would be a heat pump. So like everybody that puts in an air conditioning unit should be doing that today.
Right. And but, you can automatically switch between the furnace and the
Yeah, well, I'm sure that they have control systems that would just recognize when the ambient temperature is whatever level it needs to be switching back and forth. So it could all be done seamlessly. And I did look at the Carrier website. They explain all the facts about that. But nobody told us about that. And, you know, honestly, the people that come to do this aren't really motivated to kind of create themselves problems by giving you a bunch of choices, right?
Right.
You asked for an air conditioning unit. They show up and give you an air conditioning unit. They're not motivated to lengthen the sales cycle and explain a bunch of things.
But I think it's coming that the general knowledge, even amongst contractors, is starting to improve. And as that knowledge base improves, they will be able to sell these sorts of things. And I think given the aggressive nature of the commitments that are being made here and in the United States, that they're going to offer the heat pump first and the furnace second.
Well, you know, it'd be nice if the building codes just made them do that.
Right.
Because I think that's a big difference. The interesting thing I learned when we built the house too is the building codes recently have changed here and they really upgraded the insulation.
Hmm.
And so there wasn't really much more we could do on the insulation. So there's one where, hey, just make it in the building codes. How about make 3-pane windows standard in the building code, right?
It makes a huge difference. We put those in 10 years ago in our house. And it's just, you know, the real benefit in addition to energy efficiency is soundproofing.
Yeah, like, so they have these other benefits.
You don't hear anything from outside, dogs barking or anything. You don't hear anything. And so the triple glaze are definitely the way to go.
Yeah, and then we also put on some shading so it would kind of prevent the overheating in the summer that can cause the electricity bills to go up. Hey, here's something, though, I might have considered as well. Problem with the air-sourced heat pump is that we still need the furnace for the really cold days. The other solution is go to a ground-sourced heat pump, which is more like geothermal. And that can cost like $40,000 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, apparently Bill Gates with the Breakthrough Fund is investing in a startup and they want to get it as low as $18,000 or $20,000, but that's what their goal is. So let's say they can do that. Could have I taken that $40,000 free loan from the government and just put in a heat pump and then paid that off over the next 20 years? Now, the problem is these payoffs are very long, but would have I done that? I don't know. I mean, I think it kind of makes sense.
You're going to make sense off of, you're going to get the carbon tax, et cetera. So I think it all kind of meshes together. But let's go back to this April 2021 budget, the $3.5 billion that's allocated to lowering home energy bills via retrofits. When is this coming? This $40,000 free loan, like how does this all work?
Yeah, it probably takes a good part of 6 months or more for that to actually roll out to the consumer.
Right.
So it's a ways away. But will people take advantage of that? And history has shown some people do. But this interest-free loan thing is kind of interesting to me. I mean, generally, here's the other thing. When you are doing these sorts of things, and when you're in a housing price war, you're generally taking on more debt than you're comfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
And so are you willing, even if it's interest-free, to take even on more debt for a payback that could be like 10 plus years away?
I actually think the payback could be fairly attractive, depending on where you live.
Well, for the ground pump, the ground-sourced heat pump, I think it's going to be pretty long. But you're right. For this air-sourced heat pump, that's kind of a no-brainer if you're putting an air conditioner unit in anyway.
I think so, too. But, you know, buildings, homes, commercial buildings, et cetera, is only 12% of overall Canadian emissions, you know, the 700 and I think it's 30 gigatons or something like that. So this is actually a small sliver of a much larger pie, right?
It is. And there are energy efficiency opportunities in industry as well. And I think some of the government programs already out there are focused on that. I also think big business is really starting to turn its attention to these things because they have goals for reductions in their emissions and things like that. So I think you're going to see more interest on the business side as well. But they have the same issue. You know, if you have a certain amount of CapEx to spend this year, are you going to spend it on things that reduce your operating costs? Or are you going to do things that would increase your revenue, like add another train to your manufacturing facility, which is going to show you that you have a higher revenue? Generally, people value businesses on metrics like that more.
Yeah.
So there's always a problem in that it's hard to put capital towards these things. They are generally longer payback than some of the things that increase your revenue.
But there is, you know, increasing scrutiny for business, especially if you're publicly traded with the ESG to demonstrate that you're part of the program. You know, the thing is that businesses have chief financial officers that look at this stuff and figure out how to ration capital and make decisions on how they're going to spend their money. Households, generally speaking, do not. And some of these calculations, even if it's on the business side, the business commercial side, you know, people don't exactly know how to make the calculations because you need energy specialists to come in and demonstrate what it is. So it's an emerging kind of business, this whole energy service company model, isn't it?
I think so. And that was a focus of a recent commentary that you wrote on energy efficiency. And we'll put a link to that. And your thesis is that as we start to see these higher carbon taxes and higher costs associated with using fossil fuels, that you're going to start to see a business emerge on the residential side. You know, the residential side has lots of barriers too, is the scale of it.
Yeah.
You know, when you think about energy efficiency projects in a big industrial site, there's enough scale there to warrant that overhead.
Right.
But like to try to convince someone to get a heat pump versus an air conditioner, someone has to spend like 2 to 3 hours to explain, then that isn't really a very good business proposition. Like they use up a lot of costs in order to convince someone to make that decision.
Yeah, I think residential also including sort of multi-tenant buildings and so on, apartment buildings. I think that there's going to be an opportunity here because what's going to emerge is a combination of carbon taxes and imperatives to reduce emissions is that there is going to be an arbitrage where people with capital, institutions with capital like investors combined with energy service companies are going to basically come in and say, hey, you've got a really inefficient building. Do you realize that what you have here is a potential asset? Inefficiency is an asset almost that can be invested into and a reduction of the energy bill. The specialists can go in for do fairly dramatic improvements to the efficiency of a building and then do some sort of sharing arrangement with the owner of the building to get a payback for the company providing the capital and a payback for the owner of the building.
Yeah, and I mean, this is a thing that's been around for a while. It's called ESCOs, energy service companies, who develop, design, build, and then fund. That's the new part. They fund the projects.
Yeah.
And they basically say to the owner of the building that, you know, I will put in this equipment. You don't have to worry about anything. I will take care of it all. I will figure out what contractors need to come in, what's the best equipment.
Yeah.
And then we can share those benefits until I get a return on my investment. At the end of the day, you will have a better building. You know, because that asset is in the end is yours, but you didn't have to put that upfront capital in.
Right.
Other sources of capital can come in and fund that.
And it's going to be interesting. You know, it's also new, but you know, just thinking off the top of my head that this $40,000 interest-free loan, the energy service company might come in and say, okay, go take out that loan. I will execute, in other words, do the renovations to your energy systems, and then we'll share in the payback.
Yeah, that might be another twist on it.
The point is actually innovation is going to emerge not only on the technology side, but in terms of the business models that are going to actually demonstrate that there's value in efficiency.
Well, and as that arbitrage gets larger and larger, right? When, you know, you say people don't pay attention to it now, it's because energy is fairly cheap.
Right.
It's a fairly small part of our monthly costs.
Yeah.
But as that goes up and up and up, even though you're getting the rebate, let's talk about the rebate, but you are going to be getting a rebate that offsets that cost for you. You're still ahead if you can reduce your energy bill because you're still going to get the rebate anyway.
Yeah.
So it's saving you money. So now the business case is much better. And if someone comes to you, makes that easy, then it's kind of a no-brainer, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So I think that's going to happen. I think, by the way, that's still tons of room and opportunity for that on the industrial and big commercial building side too, although it's being done in those areas. I think those businesses could grow as well because, you know, there's a shortage of capital out there. If a different capital provider can come in and pay for those CapEx costs, that makes it easier for companies to say, hey, like, that makes a lot of sense.
I mean, to draw an analogy with the vehicle side. So it costs, I'm just sort of throw a number out for an average sedan type vehicle, say $60, $70 to fill up a tank. With your electric vehicle at Alberta electricity price rates, probably costs you $6 to fill. Mm-hmm. So the savings is $54 per trip. So imagine somebody came to you and said, Jackie, I'm going to take away your existing internal combustion engine vehicle. I'm going to give you the electric vehicle, and we're going to share that $54 in savings.
Yeah, no, it's a lot easier decision, isn't it?
Yeah. The person who effectively gives you the electric vehicle basically might say, okay, you know, realistically, I'm going to take $45 of the savings and I'm going to give you nine.
Yeah, they're going to take the vast majority of savings.
Yeah, because they're putting up the money to give you the vehicle.
Yeah.
But it's kind of a win-win situation.
Now, here's another thing I was thinking about. First of all, the win-win, it's always been there though, right? It's only going to get better now with the carbon taxes because the amount of savings are going to grow. But a lot of people don't value it still today. Like, for instance, when you go look at a brand new house, it will have things like what your tax liability will be and things like that that you look at very carefully before you agree to buy the house. Could it be in the future that it shows the op costs for this house and that buyers start to get that? Because today they don't have that information, right? And that they start to differentiate. Because I tell you, that's one thing that really stopped me from going all the way on our build is I looked around our neighborhood and I saw like these track builders are putting up houses that didn't have energy efficiency options in them. They didn't have the triple pane windows. They didn't have upgraded insulation. And buyers don't even know to ask about these things. And I will admit, before we built a house, I just looked at the kitchen and the countertops and things like that. But I never looked at, you know, the energy efficiency of the home.
Well,
are people going to get smarter and start to value things differently? Because that will motivate people even more to enter into these types of contracts.
Oh, I think so. I mean, if you go to Europe, it's already happening. Of course, I'm sort of getting somewhat sentimental about the days when I used to be able to travel and go. But if you walk around European towns, especially like, remember this in Italy, if you walk around towns in Italy and there are the real estate companies that are showcasing all the homes in the window that you can potentially buy. And, you know, so they give the price, whatever it is, 500,000 euros. But every home advertising has the efficiency published on it.
Like it's carbon?
It's like a food label.
Really?
It's basically a food label. So you can actually see on the real estate advertisement with a photo of the apartment or whatever it is you're buying, the home, what the energy consumption is. Much like the sticker in your fridge.
Or the sticker on your car.
Or you know, cars.
Well, there's
the fuel economy on your car. I actually did look it up and I can't remember at the time. It's probably legislated that they have to do that.
I was just going to say, I think that's super important. I think the building codes need to change, but I also think transparency around that metric, it needs to be there. So it's an apple-apple comparison because consumers really have no way of measuring this. I think they are going to care more in the future as these prices go up.
Well, they're
going
to have to, because
buying.
With the carbon tax is coming. You said right now, it's the worst of the situation that's gotten worse recently because, as I said, with direct debits of your bank account, to pay your utility bill, you don't even see it. There's just no visibility of what's going on. So if you can't measure it, you can't see it, you're not necessarily going to care about it. But if it has to be published and it's going to become more of a fraction of your household expenses, then I think it's going to start to become more of a priority in terms of the decision-making about buying a home.
We'll wrap this up. We'll put a link to Peter's commentary in the show notes. Please check that out. Thanks to our listeners. If you enjoyed this podcast, please rate us on the app that you listen to and tell someone else about us.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.